From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, the keeper of The Blacklist, the annual compilation of Hollywood's most loved unproduced screenplays. Plus, the accidental writer behind Showtime's The Big C. But first, the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, good news or bad news for 3D? Lots going on in the 3D world.
I think it's good news. I mean, Paramount had Jackass 3D come out and do very good business over the weekend. So,
was it Jackass or was it the 3D? What was it?
I think it was the three-dimensional feces that was flung over the audience. I think that's what really sold moviegoers on the experience. But this comes on the heels of Warner Brothers saying that Harry Potter will not be flying in 3D come this Christmas.
Yes, what are the Potter fans called? I'm sure some of them are very happy.
I think they are happy that if it's going to look bad. I mean, this is a studio
This is Warner Brothers, right?
Correct. And they started the after-the-fact 3D conversion, meaning they took films that were shot in 2D, Clash of the Titans being a very good example, and kind of retrofitted them to make them look, and not really appear, but look as if they were shot in 3D.
And this has not been well received, and so maybe they decided not to mess. You know, if you have Harry Potter, I don't know, you need to gild that lily, although maybe they would have made more money with doing it in 3D. But
I think without question they would have made more money, and there's some estimates it could have been as much as $45 million in domestic box office revenues alone. But I think it shows that when it comes to Harry Potter, Warner's has a different standard for quality and execution. Now, the second Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows films, which comes out next summer, will still, according to the studio, be in 3D. But they didn't think they could get this one right enough to do it, and so they canceled the plans.
And I kind of have to bet that as the technology improves, maybe they're going to do something like what George Lucas is doing with Star Wars and just take the whole thing soup to nuts and start a 3D and remilk that franchise. Hard to believe they can resist that temptation down the road. Meanwhile, the horse that was supposed to come flying out of the gate for Disney came up a little bit lame. Secretariat, not the opening that Disney had wished for the week before this past weekend. They really, as I think we've talked about, pushed the heck out of this thing, trying to position it as an Oscar movie. And it left the still new regime at Disney, Rich Ross and his marketing person, M.T. Carney, with a bit of a mess to clean up.
And they went into immediate defensive mode. I mean, the film wasn't even done with its first weekend, and I saw stories with M.T. Carney where she was defending some of the marketing choices she made on the film. I think it's still, you know, the ultimate tale of that film's success or failure won't be told for a number of weeks since it appeals to older moviegoers and they don't rush out to the theater on opening weekend, the movie could have long legs. But it was obviously a very disappointing opening. And this is a movie that Disney said, this is the kind of film we want to be making. And if the audience not completely rejected it, but did not turn out in droves for the film, I think it sends a very worrisome signal to the studio about not only the kinds of movies they're picking, but how they're marketing their films.
And what was extraordinary to me was M.T. Carney, essentially the marketing chief, pleading for more time, publicly saying, I need more time to learn my job. Now, there is one racehorse in Hollywood who just really runs, and that is Ryan Seacrest. We broke the story at The Hollywood Reporter recently that he is in preliminary talks with CAA and AEG, the music concert company, to start a cable channel, which is really remarkable when you think about the amount of stuff that Ryan Seacrest does. You know, he's re-upping his deal for his radio show. I gather that the people who Clear Channel, which is the behind that radio show, is starting to get kind of nervous about Ryan Seacrest on American Idol, Ryan Seacrest doing stuff for E, Ryan Seacrest having a radio show, Ryan Seacrest talking about launching a cable channel. That's a lot of stuff for any guy. He's known to be a terrific worker. So he's downplaying that he's going to be on air a lot. But he would be involved, and I think they try to take advantage of these venues they have around the world. You know, they have the Staples Center here. They have a gigantic arena in London, and, you know, musical acts coming and going. So they could do stuff like that. I find the CAA, you know, the biggest, they just had a deal themselves where they got a big infusion of cash, and they have money in which to expand into other businesses. And while it's not completely clear that this is how they're using that money for this, it kind of looks that way, that this is a business that they would start. So, you know, big players.
And if you look at what's going on in television and movie business, if you're a talent agent, there's only a limited amount of money you're able to get from that business, and it's contracting and the salaries are going down. So I guess if you have an entrepreneur, and I don't know if Ryan Seacrest has the appeal, the name brand appeal of Oprah, who is starting her own cable network, but I guess they're worst ideas in the history of Hollywood.
You know, with all the troubles that the Oprah Winfrey Network is having with its launch, which is supposed to happen in January, and they've also already spent about double the $100 million that was budgeted to do this Oprah Winfrey Network, it's a problem. I'm wondering whether Ryan Seacrest is, at this point, a broader and, you know, more appealing heartland character than she may be and have an easier time with this.
I just, he's a little bit more decisive, too, than Oprah has been.
Well, he certainly seems to get things done. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. A couple of weeks ago, writer Kyle Killen was a guest on the show talking about his wild ride in Hollywood. He created the quickly canceled TV series Lone Star, and he wrote The Beaver, a movie with an uncertain future because it stars Mel Gibson. So Killen's had some tough luck lately, but on a brighter note, he told us when his screenplay for The Beaver was number one on the blacklist in 2008, his life changed overnight.
You absolutely go from begging and borrowing to get a look at stuff and to meet with people and to talk about your ideas to, you know, the phone calls come the other way.
The Blacklist is an insider's compilation of the most loved unproduced scripts making the rounds in a given year. Today we talk with the creator and keeper of that list, Franklin Leonard. Leonard is currently a development executive at Universal Studios. The Blacklist is an entirely independent project for him. It began in 2005 when he was working for Leonardo DiCaprio's production company, Appian Way. Leonard was frustrated by the lack of quality scripts coming across his desk. He says he's an Excel nerd with a penchant for surveys, so he decided to poll the town. He asked 75 assistants and executives to list their 10 favorite unproduced scripts for the year. Leonard then crunched the numbers, and in early December 2005, he emailed the results back to those who voted. Then he went on vacation. By the time he got back, 2 weeks later, that first blacklist had become a viral phenomenon, and he's been doing it ever since. By now, more than 300 executives from Los Angeles, New York, and London vote anonymously, and the list comes out the second week of December. Last year's included scripts well on their way to getting made, like The Social Network, and some less settled screenplays, such as The Muppet Man, about the life of Jim Henson. This year, the list lands on December 13th. It goes out first just to those who voted, and a few hours later, it's posted on the official Blacklist website. When Franklin Leonard came in to talk to us, I started by asking why he called it the Blacklist.
It's meant to be a vaguely subversive name. I have a very distinct memory as a kid being in an English class and being told that symbolically, if you're reading a novel and you see something that's black, a black hat on a cowboy, a black cape on a musketeer, in all probability, that's your bad guy. And so I remember at the time, even though I was quite young, like I could make the extrapolation to what that could mean for a black character. And that was troubling to me, even at that young age.
And I should point out to people who cannot see you, that you are black.
Yes, I am. And so I think since then, I've always sort of carried a desire to subvert or invert that in some way. And so that instinct combined with the history of the term blacklist in Hollywood sort of provided a really fun opportunity to sort of be vaguely antagonistic when I put this first thing out. I didn't at the time know that the list was going to become what it became. And so I don't know that I would have called it that.
Could I go back?
Had I known. I'm glad that I did. And again, I think
it's catchy. It's better than like the really good script list.
Exactly. But it definitely, I don't know that I would have had the courage to call it that had I known what it was going to become. I think what worked out really well was that it was just a list of scripts that I was putting together because I wanted to read some good scripts over the holidays. And then when it became a thing, it already had the name The Blacklist. And I was able to keep it.
And the original purpose was simply for you to find scripts. Has it changed now what the purpose of it is?
There's a line at the beginning of each list that says, you know, the Blacklist is not a best of list. It is at best a most liked list. You know, not every screenplay on the list is something that everybody's going to like. It is just a sort of snapshot of what people are reading and talking about. And just because everybody loves something doesn't mean that you are necessarily going to like it or that I'm necessarily going to like it. And so I hope that the list does not become some sort of definitive document about sort of who people should be in business with, because ultimately this is a very subjective world that we inhabit. And just because everyone likes something doesn't necessarily mean that it's good.
So at this point, your number of advisors has expanded. Right?
Yeah, it's expanded considerably.
Do you call them advisors?
Voters, advisors, I don't think there's an official term.
Okay.
Participants.
And how do you get to be one of those people?
At this point, the list tries to present a snapshot of, let's say, the mainstream Hollywood filmmaking community on the executive side. So I'm not surveying agents or managers because I assume that they have an implicit bias. I would hope that they have an implicit bias toward their own clients' work. But at this point, it's pretty much, if you're an executive at a production company, studio, or financier that sort of released a movie into, you know, American cinemas in the previous 2 or 3 years, you're an eligible voter and you're asked to contribute. And that means that we get in the neighborhood of 350 votes each year out of a pool of about 500.
I assume that these have to be anonymous ballots.
They're 100% anonymous.
So you know who sent what, but you...
I don't even know who sent what.
We How
actually,
does this work?
Well, now it's administered by a website that was set up by a good friend of mine, Dino Siamic, whereby people receive an email with the sort of code. They go on, they put their code in to confirm that it's them. They put their list of scripts in, and then that it's those scripts are output to a spreadsheet, but I don't know who's voted for what.
So why would they do it?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think that there's an assumption that, you know, when you're working in Hollywood and you have a piece of information about a piece of material, you want to keep that to yourself so that no one else knows. But I think that because it is anonymous, I think that because it is something that does have sort of wide participation, the cost of participating is far less than the benefit of having participated. You know, the more people that do participate, the more accurate the snapshot is of what the community is talking about and reading. And so at the end of the year, when you have this list that's a semi-accurate depiction of what the community conversation is, it's a real opportunity to say, okay, these are the things that I need to read over the holidays. These are writers that are actually really talented that I might not have known about and maybe can get in business with. I think that's why. I'm sure people have their own individual reasons, but that's, you know, based on a highly unscientific survey of participants, that seems
right.
to be it.
Well, you say it's unscientific, and I assume that you somehow, it's just part of the deal that you get to vote for your own script if you manage to be an advisor or a participant.
Certainly you can. But I would say that most people don't necessarily, unless they have a real abiding belief that the scripts that they're working on is quite good. I think that, again, there's a real incentive to sort of play by the rules written and unwritten, because if you're not, then the list is going to be fundamentally corrupted and ultimately valueless. I'm sure people do sort of try to influence the list. I'm sure people do, you know, call each other and say, hey, can you vote for mine? I'll vote for yours. But at this point, there are so many voters, and the threshold for being on the actual list itself is high enough that I think that you'd have to mount a pretty impressive public relations campaign or actually have a legitimately good piece of material to actually sort of cross that threshold. And again, that's another reason why I want to make very clear to people that sort of use the list or read the list or are familiar with it that it is not by any means a best of list, because, you know, I acknowledge that it's possible that it can be manipulated in small ways, but ultimately, here's a guide for scripts that you might enjoy.
Right.
Read them and decide for yourself.
Right. Do you get lobbied? Do people call you up and say, can I be an advisor?
I definitely do have requests, and that's one of the reasons why I've sort of gone to great pains to sort of clearly delineate sort of what the rules are that define what a participant is, and so it's not really just subject to my whims. I can say I've never been offered a bribe to get a script on the list, which sort of both makes the sort of moral and ethical part of me, makes me very happy, and my wallet, you know, cries tears at night.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Franklin Leonard, the creator and keeper of The Blacklist, the annual compilation of the most loved, unproduced screenplays making the rounds in Hollywood.
I'm always very reluctant to take too much credit for the success of any of the projects that have been on the list. At the end of the day, you know, I think what the list does is shine a spotlight on great work or work that is beloved. And that spotlight can encourage other people to read it, possibly decision makers. It can sort of represent for those decision makers a critical mass so that if there's not a high concept that, you know, someone is necessarily interested in buying, well, maybe this is so well executed, even though it's a bit odd, that it's something that we should invest in.
The scrap of validation goes far in Hollywood.
I think it does. And I think especially when you look at the history of the list and some of the scripts that have been on it, that, you know, when you on the face of them would not be something that Hollywood would embrace or that the American public would embrace. I mean, you know, two of the top four scripts on the first year's list were nominated for Academy Awards for Best Original Screenplay.
Tell us which ones those were.
That was Juno and Lars and the Real Girl, and Juno obviously won. Slumdog Millionaire was on the list, I think, in 2006. There are certainly scripts that are on the list that are well on their way to production with major movie stars attached and studios putting a significant amount of money behind them. And there are also scripts that, you know, very few people have heard of or very few people have thought of as anything other than a wildly brilliant sample that will never get made.
Do you have any sense at this point of what makes a script list-worthy? Are there elements that they have
That's
in
really
common?
Interesting. In terms of differentiating what makes a blacklist script from a sort of mainstream successful commercial movie, I think they tend to be a little bit smaller in scope and more human. I think they probably tend to be a little bit darker in tone than your sort of average movie made by a major American studio. But and I think they probably are something that people aren't quite expecting the writer to be able to pull off. You know, it's a story about a high school girl who's going to put her baby up for adoption, and it's told in a way that by the end you can't quite believe that you enjoyed it for 110, you know, 15 pages. You know, and that's Juno. It's the story of a young man who decides that a blow-up doll is his girlfriend, and you can't quite believe that at the end of the day, that's Lars and the Real Girl.
Lars and the Real
and
Girl.
And you can't quite believe that you're on the verge of tears by the end of the script. It's the story of a man who puts a beaver puppet on his hand, and you think about your life a little bit differently when you finish reading the script.
It sort of works like a TV thing where writers will write a script for a TV show, never expecting that script to get made, but hoping that something else will come. It'll be a calling card.
You know, if I was going to describe it anyway, it would be that the writers have set a wildly ambitious task for themselves and that they've carried it off in some way. Rather than, I'm going to tell a story that, you know, has been told a million times before and tell it in pretty much the way that it's always been told and do a good enough job. Most of the time, these writers are setting an incredibly high bar for themselves, writing with a unique voice and successfully sort of meeting the bar that they set.
You work for a big studio, and you know what's been going on with the toys and the sequels and the comic books. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the blacklist is at odds with where Hollywood is right now.
I don't think it necessarily is. I think that many of the scripts that are sort of at the major studios based on these toys and games are not on the list, possibly because the studios have a real incentive to make sure that they aren't widely distributed. So even the best versions of the script, like the script for The Dark Knight, for example, or the Bourne movies, never shows up on the blacklist because no one gets to read those until the movie comes out. But the blacklist is about identifying both great material and talented writers.
Right.
And if we can take those talented writers and put them on the, you know, toys, the games, whatever it is, these sort of, quote, pre-sold properties, unquote, there's no reason why something that is titled after a toy or a game can't be a brilliant movie as well. It's just a matter of finding the good story that's sort of told around whatever this high concept is and it is ultimately being used as a marketing tool.
Franklin Leonard is the creator of The Blacklist, an annual list of the most liked, unproduced screenplays being shopped around Hollywood. He is also a development executive at Universal Studios. The Blacklist comes out the second week of December. Thank you so much for coming to see us.
Thank you for having me.
The official website of The Blacklist has an archive of the past 5 years. You can find a link on our website, kcrw.org/thebusiness. Have you ever hunted down a script because it was on The Blacklist? Tell us on the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. Coming up after a short break, Darlene Hunt, the accidental writer behind Showtime's The Big C. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and kcrw.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The Showtime series The Big C stars Laura Linney as a wife and mother who decides to live her life differently, more spontaneously, once she's diagnosed with stage 4 cancer.
Given our last visit, I would have expected to see you next in a hot air balloon or midair on a trapeze.
I have a lump.
Where?
On my ass. You might have a more clinical word for it, but I didn't go to med school.
No, we called it ass when there are no patients around.
Cancer may not seem like the most hilarious premise, but this is one of those quirky half-hour Showtime comedies, like Weeds and The United States of Tara, starring a top-notch actress tackling life's unpredictability with dark humor. The Big C was created by writer Darlene Hunt, who also acts, though not on the show. In fact, Hunt's plan when she first came to Hollywood was to be a star, and a younger version of herself might be disappointed that her first real TV series, which has already been renewed for a second season, didn't star Darlene Hunt. But like many before and since, Hunt found that the road to stardom was blocked, so she tried something else.
I wrote like a little play. A playlet, if
what
you will.
What was the impulse for that?
I was just always desperate to perform and for people to see me perform and to just stay busy. And so I wrote a play called Platonically Incorrect that I did with my friend. It was like 30 minutes. And then his friend, an actor by the name of Sean Hayes, came out to see the show.
Heard of him, Will and Grace.
Yep, and Will and Grace was sort of in its heyday, but for some reason Sean was very bored that summer. And he's like, I really like your writing. I'd love to do the show with you. So I just wrote him this little dorky part, and we turned it into an hour and 10-minute piece. And, of course, there were lines around the block because Sean Hayes was in it.
I mean, let me just stop for 1 second there, because there's part of me that goes, really, you're just dabbling and you're just or are you just deadly serious about this is a vehicle to be an actress?
I was deadly serious that it was a vehicle to be an actress.
Okay, just to be clear.
And, you know, to the point, so a lot of agents at UTA came out to see Sean because they hoped to sign him. And then afterwards, one of them asked me who wrote the play, because I realized I didn't even put in the program a written by credit. It didn't even occur to me to say that I had written it.
Were you sitting somewhere and this idea? I mean, I know we're into difficult economic times now, and a lot of people are sitting around thinking, what do I do? What do I do? How can I get my career or redirect right. my career? So were you sitting somewhere and was your acting slow or not at the level you wanted? I'm trying to get to the point where you suddenly decide, I'm writing this thing.
I was sitting in a coffee shop doing The Artist Way. Have you heard The Artist Way?
I have, the book. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that was my – I was going through like
– You're going to sell books now.
I get no money for that one.
Okay, just to be
but,
clear.
But, you know, I was just doing my own sort of career, creative self-help. And I was doing The Artist Way, and I would always write in my journal. And because I was doing comedy, I was inspired to write for myself. But it really was a means to acting work. And then the writing agents asked me to sign as a writer, and I was very conflicted. And I finally agreed, and I threw myself on my bed and felt like I had, you know, given up my acting career. And then at the same time, the creators of Will and Grace came to see the show and asked me to write an episode of Will and Grace, which I turned down at first.
Oh.
And then changed my mind a week later. But I did come to my senses. And that really was my first sort of foray into writing for TV and to writing episodic television. And I actually did a small guest star in that same episode that I wrote.
Was that part of the deal?
It wasn't. They gave it to me sort of afterwards as a little gift. Here's a little acting gift.
A little bonus for you, yeah. So when you started writing, you did Will and Grace, you're still thinking, but I'm really an actress.
Right, right.
And is there a shift at some point where you say, actually, I'm a writer, but I act?
No, I was still doing that play, Platonically Incorrect. I sold it as a TV pilot to ABC. And so that was the first pilot that I wrote, and they actually made it. And we shot a couple of episodes, but they never aired them. So that's when I started writing pilots. And that was like 2001, and I'd been writing pilots ever since. And the turning point was where I finally got my dream of becoming a series regular on a TV show. And it was Help Me Help You for ABC. It was a short-lived series that starred Ted Danson. And here every day I would drive to work and just have to remind myself, this is your dream. This is your dream. You have a regular job as an actress. You are a series regular. But honestly, as great as it was, and I love sitting in the makeup chair, I got a little bored.
So as someone who has done auditioning and I assume pitching at this point, mm-hmm, since you're, mm-hmm. I mean, I assume you've been pitching for a while since that happened. How different are those two processes?
You know, I'd say they're very much the same. At least the way I do them is kind of the same. I get very angst-ridden beforehand. And then during the pitch or the audition, I kind of lose sense of time and where I am and kind of go into a hyper-insecure mode. And then I walk away and I'm not sure what happened. But a pitch for sure is very, performance-oriented. And especially in pitching comedy, you got to make them laugh. And I know if I've walked away from a comedy pitch and I feel like, you know, I did everything on my notes sheet and I explained the series and they get it and they know me as a writer. But I know if I didn't make them laugh, there's no way they're going to buy it.
And do you try to write roles for yourself when you do these sitcoms?
You'd think my dream would be to blend the two. But it seems that when I'm writing, there's so much that goes into writing a pilot and then when you're on set and in production, that the idea of acting in it as well is a little bit mind-numbing. So, I mean, that would be great to blend the two at some point, but that's not one of my main goals.
So you pitched a bunch of shows before you finally, we'll say, struck pay dirt.
That's right. The Big C was my ninth pilot.
Now, did Showtime, did you go straight there? Did you try it somewhere else?
No, we pitched just four regular networks. Do you just call them regular networks? Two of which, broadcast networks, right? The first two pitches were terrible. I did not make my audience laugh. They were depressed. I was depressed. I was like, this is a terrible show. I don't know what I'm doing. And we actually canceled the rest of the pitches that were on the table at the time because I was like, I am not ready. I don't know what this is. So I went away again and I sort of revamped the pitch and tried to find the funny. And then we pitched it to ABC and Showtime and they both wanted to buy it. But I was really just chomping at the bit to work in cable because I hadn't done that. And I felt like, you know, I could go even darker if I was at Showtime.
Well, that's what writers always tell us. You know, if I were in cable, you know, I could do this.
But there's more money in the other.
Does it seem like a suck-in-your-breath sacrifice or no?
You know, when you look at just the numbers,
yeah,
it sucks in your breath.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is you're not getting paid for episodes that never get picked up.
Right.
And I really felt like in this case, Showtime was more likely to pick it up. And I was afraid that ABC would have so many choices that they would never pick up the series. So it doesn't really matter how much money that would be. And the other piece of it is obviously part of the reason it's a bigger payday is you got 22 episodes compared to, say, 13. And being a new mom, the idea of doing 13 as a series seemed much lovelier.
And do you identify as a writer now or an actress or a writer-actress?
You know, it's a funny...
I don't know why we want to categorize you. Why can't we just let you be you?
You know, just let me be me. Because I feel like that's happened a few times. There's always seems to be that there has to be a choice. And if I'm writing something and an audition comes up, there's a lot of, like, checks and balances that goes on. Is that legal for me to do? Is that going to take me away from the writing commitment? But I feel like... I don't know. Doesn't George Clooney do both? Can I be like him?
Yes.
Can't people just do everything?
Darlene Hunt is the creator and executive producer of Showtime's The Big C, starring Laura Linney and Oliver Platt. She's also a working actress. Thank you so much.
I am absolutely honored to be here.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is the executive producer. The theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. To leave a comment about today's show, email us at thebusiness@kcrw.org or go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.